Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We don't have time for trying to score political points or maneuvering or positioning. Not on this.
We've made clear that we're fighting for the largest spending cuts possible. We're talking about real spending cuts here. No smoke and mirrors.
Speaker of the House John Boehner and President Obama, with the government shutdown looming for Friday night at midnight and the short-term budget showdown now getting a longer-term companion proposal from House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan to overhaul Medicare and Medicaid to reduce the deficit by trillions of dollars over the next 10 years.
It is a plan to give our children a debt-free nation so they, too, can realize their American dream.
We'll have four guests on all this over the next half hour, beginning with Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Western Tennessee, known as a favorite of the Tea Party. Congresswoman, so nice of you to give an out-of-town station some time. Hello from New York.
Well, I am absolutely delighted to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
First, on the immediate conflict, Democrats say there was a deal for $33 billion in cuts, and suddenly Speaker Boehner is demanding 40 because the Tea Party faction isn't satisfied. Is that how you see it?
I don't think there's ever been a deal. I mean, my goodness, this has been, we've gone over this time and again. What you have to realize and remember is that we have sent the bill over to the Senate, and they have not taken any action. As a matter of fact, they have been kicking this can down the road now for over a year. When the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, they refused to do a budget because they were afraid they were going to have to vote on something that might have a politically negative effect. And so they waited and wanted to go to a continuing resolution. And then after we took over in January, handed it to us, and now they're against everything. So, you know, they haven't brought anything forward, haven't put anything on the table. And I think the question of the week is, what will Harry do? Is Harry Reid going to shut down the government, or is it going to stay open?
The original Republican proposal was for $61 billion. Would you rather see the government shut down than accept a $33 billion immediate cut?
I think what we have to do is realize that $61 billion in cuts out of $2.6 trillion in spending is not much. And the American people have said they want to see the spending reduced. And our goal is to make these cuts in some programs this year and then move on to the 2012 budget. So we'll see what the next couple of days, what it holds. But we have sent our proposals across to the Senate. The Senate has so far not taken anything up and sent anything back.
I read that Speaker Boehner is now demanding $40 billion in cuts. Would you accept $40
billion? I don't think there's any deal. You know, we don't know what they're putting on the table. So, yeah, it's a question that you can't answer because you don't know what they're going to put on the table. And so far, we haven't seen anything, and I've not heard in one meeting about there being a deal. There was all this conversation around the $33 billion number, but it's something we've not seen, and Speaker Boehner has said repeatedly that there is no deal.
Let's say it is 40. We toss these numbers around like poker chips or Monopoly money, but what would get cut in that extra $7 billion?
Well, we don't know because you don't know how they would construct it, and that's why it is so difficult to have a conversation on it. We sent them some things that are concrete, cuts that need to be made, that should be made, and sent them a document 46 days ago that they have not taken up. So the ball is in their court. And what we want to do is fund the government through the rest of this fiscal year and then move to the 2012 budget, where we are cutting $5.8 trillion out of the baseline spending. And that is a number that is achievable and doable. It gets us on the course to actually bringing this budget into balance. And the sooner we get started, then the sooner we're going to be able to pull this budget into balance.
Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, our first guest today here on the Brian Lehrer Show. Moving on to the Ryan plan that you were just referring to, trillions from the deficit. Critics are saying this is an extremely ideological way to solve the deficit problem because Ryan would cut taxes on the wealthy another 10 percentage points, not cut the military at all, and therefore inflict all the pain on the old and the poor with these Medicaid and Medicare cuts. Is this an extremely ideological or narrow approach?
I think that the budget is a responsible approach to getting us on the road to fiscal health. We know that indeed you have to go after discretionary spending, but more importantly, you have to look at options and operations in our trust fund systems, and you have to look at the way you're dealing with entitlements, such as Medicaid. What we have heard from our states and what we see in the Ryan approach is moving forward and moving to a block grant system where the states can administer those Medicaid programs. I think it's a way that is practical, where you say, where are our problems? How do we begin to work our way out of this and reduce the size and scope of the federal government, reduce the size of the bureaucracy? Of course, looking at a 10% reduction in the federal workforce over the next 10 years, and begin to work our way out of this. They're attainable goals, they're realistic goals, and I think that, this is the first year where we have a budget that begins to make reductions, and that the sooner we get it in place and start on this pathway to fiscal accountability, then the easier it is going to be to have a budget next year that also moves us further along that path to reductions in spending accountability.
Do you think this would increase inequality in America, and would that be acceptable to you? We had a debate on the show last week over a couple of days between two different economists. One of them was the chairman of President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, Glenn Hubbard, who acknowledged that the top 1% in America now have 25% of the income each year. It used to be half that 25 years ago. If we're cutting Medicaid in this kind of way, and Medicare, which might increase elder poverty, while further decreasing the taxes on the top 1%, would that exacerbate inequality in America even further, and would that be acceptable?
What will exacerbate inequality in America is continuing to burden our children with debt, with a future of despair, because we have, through all of this excessive and extreme spending that this group continues to do, the Democrats continue to push, what you are doing is capping our children's future and trading it to the nations that hold our debt.
And clearly the Democrats have no plan.
Yeah, I find it inconceivable that there is no plan from the Democrats, that all they want to do is spend, spend, spend. I have two grandsons, and I am offended that the Democrats want to continue to spend money they do not have. They're borrowing 42 cents out of every dollar that is being spent. They're spending money they do not have for programs that we do not want, and certainly that our children and grandchildren don't want.
But
I think it's economic child abuse.
My question was a little different than that. Assuming that there's a deficit reduction goal that everybody agrees on and the necessity for it, and then it's a question of how you get there. Is getting there this way, only through Medicaid and Medicare, while leaving the military harmless and reducing taxes even further on the wealthy, going to increase inequality? And is
no,
that acceptable?
Because you're going to get there through a variety of ways. You're going to provide more options for seniors as you look at Medicare reforms for those that retire past the year 2021. So you're going to provide more options for them, so that they can have a premium support and move into a plan that is very similar to the federal employee benefit plan. So that gives them another option. It is a way for saying to seniors that retire after that date, if you like the Medicare that you thought you were going to have, you can keep it. And that is a way to provide more options from them. I hear I hear from seniors every single day that they want options, that they would like to be able to have a premium support payment every year to stay in their health insurance plan with their employer because they're not going to retire at 65. They're not planning to retire until they're 72. So, you know, you're beginning to hear this from seniors that, hey, look, we're working longer, and we want access to options. What you're seeing through the Ryan plan is an opportunity for seniors and for individuals as they plan toward when they want to retire, which is most likely not going to be at 65, but it's going to be at 72 or 75, that they have other options that they can exercise.
You said if they like Medicare as it is, they can keep it, but my understanding is that the Ryan plan does not offer that as an option.
Well, it offers them the opportunity to keep the Medicare benefits that would be there. What we have to realize is individuals have paid into Medicare. This is something that comes out of their paycheck, their Medicare and their Social Security. That is why those are trust fund accounts. And what we want to make certain is that individuals get their money back out of those accounts. This is a way that they can do that.
And just one other thing on the Ryan plan. As I understand it, the Ryan budget does not claim that the tax cut produces more revenue over the 10-year period. It produces less. Do I understand that correctly? In other words, that the theory often is that if we cut taxes, then the private economy will grow so much that it will produce more government revenue in the long run.
The revenue estimates that are coming from CBO. What I think you have to consider in that is that CBO does not use dynamic scoring. What they use is a static scoring base, which basically means that they do not, CBO does not take into account a policy change yielding behavioral change. What we know from experience, even though CBO does not use a dynamic scoring method, is that a policy change does give you a behavioral change. And indeed, the Heritage Center for Data Policy Analysis has estimated that the Ryan plan would create 1 million new jobs the first year out of the chute.
And we are going to have a Heritage Foundation guest next, along with others in a politically diverse roundtable. Just one thing on the Medicaid reforms. Looking at your state, Tennessee, as an example, would it be harder on the state taxpayers and on the recipients if instead of a federal program, Medicaid would become just a block grant to the states, the same every year, even in times like these where more unemployment means more people enrolling? Would that shift an undue burden onto the states like Tennessee?
No, Tennessee actually was the test case for Hillary Clinton health care. We know what the burden of public option health care is because it nearly bankrupted our state. The program grew to be 35.3% of the state. What we hear regularly from those that have been involved with TennCare, from our state legislators, is they would much rather have a block grant free of the stranglehold of the federal government and unencumbered by all of the attachments that come with federal dollars, and be able to handle that program at the state level, that it would save money, that they would be able to provide greater certainty to enrollees in the program, and that they can do a better job of managing that program, the growth, the contractions or expansions in size, the number of enrollees, the benefits that are there for enrollees. So to free them from the constraints and the problems with the federal government, I think, is something that they're looking forward to.
Okay. We have 60 seconds left. Two quick questions. One, what do you think is going to happen Friday night at midnight?
We're going to wait and see what Harry Reid will do. I think that's the question of the week. What will Harry do?
And if John Boehner comes to an agreement that's in the 30s, 30-plus billion of cuts, no more than that, will there be a Tea Party revolt?
We'll see what's on the table.
Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Western Tennessee. Again, we really, really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Ryan Lehrer on WNYC. We're going to stay on this topic coming up next. More clips of Paul Ryan on his plan a clip expressing support for the idea of it from a former Clinton budget director, and a politically diverse roundtable on the gridlock and shutdown threat and the real meaning of the Ryan plan for changing Medicare and Medicaid. Stay with us.
Question with healthcare going forward is either healthcare is going to be run by 30,000 bureaucrats in Washington with command and control and price controls, or 300 million Americans acting as consumers demanding performance and competition among doctors, hospitals, insurers for our business.
House Budget Committee Chairman Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican from Wisconsin, now a politically diverse roundtable on the gridlock and shutdown threat and the real meaning of the Ryan plan for overhauling Medicare and Medicaid and reducing the deficit. Another person who likes the idea, by the way, of replacing single-payer Medicare with a market-based system, former Clinton budget director Alice Rivlin.
The government would then be able to control the amount of the subsidy or the growth of the subsidy. Right now, Medicare is a fee-for-service system, and the government just has to pay the bills, whatever they are.
Alice Rivlin, former Clinton administration budget director. With me now, Paul Starr, health policy expert, co-founder of the Liberal American Prospect magazine and a senior health policy advisor under President Clinton. John Heilman, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, co-author of Game Change about the 2008 Obama campaign, the bestseller. And from the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, senior research fellow Ed Hazelmeyer. Welcome, all of you. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Paul Starr, I suspect you won't be a big fan of the Ryan plan, but you heard your former colleague Alice Rivlin there. Single-payer Medicare is unsustainable as the population ages and demands grow. Do you disagree?
I do disagree, and I wish Alice would pay more attention to the historical evidence, the record. The record is that Medicare has done a better job of controlling costs than have the private Medicare plans that Republicans have emphasized in 2003. They introduced a system of payment that has grossly overpaid those private insurance plans. The Republicans are the people who brought us the deficit with the Bush tax cuts. This Ryan budget is not necessarily going to bring a balanced budget because of the tax cuts on the wealthiest.
Ed from Heritage, the Ryan plan wouldn't even retain single-payer Medicare as a public option. Why not let Medicare, as we know it, as efficient as it is in terms of overhead at least, compete on price and benefits with limits the government would have to place on expenditures and see if it survives?
Well, first of all, it would retain it for the current retirees. This change that is being proposed would be for people like myself, you know, who are a number of years away from retirement.
And I'm glad you said that, just so we don't scare people unnecessarily who are currently dependent on Medicare. This would be for people 55 and under today when they get to that age.
That's right. It's changing the relationship going forward. Secondly, Medicare really doesn't do a better job. And in fact, the rates of fraud are vastly higher than in these public programs, both Medicare and Medicaid, than they are in the private insurance. You know, the private insurance gets beaten up for administrative costs. Well, you know, a lot of the administrative cost goes to making sure the right amount gets paid to the right people for the right thing. If you get rid of that, yeah, you'll save on administrative costs, but then you open up the door to all sorts of fraud, and we see that in Medicare and Medicaid. It's a systemic problem. The larger issue really in this is a couple of things. One, who's entitled to something under Medicare? The problem we have today is that Medicare doesn't actually entitle the beneficiary to anything. What the people getting the entitlement are the doctors and hospitals. They're entitled to get paid if they do things. What this proposal would do is to say, no, the beneficiary is entitled to a certain amount of money, and then the beneficiary has increased power and choice on how to spend that money.
Well, it's the insurance
to get the
company.
Best value.
It's the insurance company that would be entitled to the certain amount of money
No.
if the buyer wanted that plan, right?
Well, no. What it would be is the beneficiary is the one that gets to choose, and so it fundamentally changes, and this is very important because this is a complex system. It fundamentally changes who these intermediaries work for. You know, who does the doctor or hospital work for? Who does the insurance company work for? Right now they work for the government. In the system that Representative Ryan is proposing, they would work for the consumer, and if the consumer didn't like the results they were getting, they could go choose somebody else.
Paul Starr, you want to come back on that?
Yeah, this is just double talk, because Medicare beneficiaries can choose the private plans now. To say this is increased choice is totally misleading. It's diminished choice. They would no longer have the option of the traditional Medicare program. And by eliminating the traditional Medicare program, this proposal would eliminate all the rights that people enjoy under Medicare. There would be no guarantee, especially because the capped rate of growth in the voucher, that capped rate of growth wouldn't necessarily buy the benefits that people now have. This is really, I think people have to understand, this is really class legislation. It's a tax cut for people at the top from a 35% rate to a 25% rate, and it's a block grant of Medicaid and a limit on the amount of money for Medicare, and the real result of that is that low-income people are going to get screwed.
Well, I don't think that that's true, and it is true, however, that it's a limit, and that's what we need. We need to limit these things. We can't continue to spend endlessly on them. We're reaching the point very soon where that will have severe negative repercussions in the economy and in all our well-being if we continue the structure that we have today. So what you have to do is you have to say, look, there is a limit to what can be taxed and spent, and then within that limit, we're going to give people, whether it's states in Medicaid or individuals in Medicaid or individuals in Medicare, the ability to, first of all, we're going to decide who actually gets it, and then we're going to say, you make the detailed decisions as to how you want to spend it.
All right. Let me bring John Heilman from New York Magazine and Game Change in here. John, love or hate the Ryan plan, everyone's giving Paul Ryan credit for political courage to start the conversation about long-term debt reduction and have Democrats take aim at it and have conversations like this. Why did he take this step?
Well, Brian, I think, I think he is obviously getting that credit. And I frankly think he deserves it, especially in contrast to what we've seen from the president on this issue, which is that he talks about it in a kind of platitudinous way. He says that it's a huge problem and then has sort of punted on the issue in terms of his own budget proposal. I think he has taken it on because he is concerned about the long-term fiscal sanity and the fiscal America's fiscal house, and he wants to put it in order. I think he is ideologically committed in a very deep way to a very different vision of, I think Paul Ryan is, and much of the Republican Party today is, to a very different vision of what the role of government should be going forward in the 21st century, and what the shape, size, and extent of the safety net should be. And I think no one should mistake, and I'm going to say it's a radical proposal, and by that I don't mean that in a partisan way. I don't mean not everything that's radical is bad. It's a very, very dramatic proposal, certainly as dramatic as anything we've seen in this regard, since the mid-90s when the Republicans tried to do this last time, maybe going back several generations before that. And I think there's a mix of ideological commitment, personal commitment on Paul Ryan's part, and then there's a political component to it, right, which is that Republicans truly believe that there's political benefit, especially with the key voting bloc, not just partly with their base, which obviously wants to see the government be smaller, and that's been traditionally true of Republican politics, but increasingly they believe with the independent voters in the country who are alarmed by the growth of the federal government, again, as they see it under Barack Obama in particular. And I think they believe that they are right and that they will get credit for trying to tackle what is a real problem in the way that they're doing it.
Is there a political analysis, and you're a political analyst, so is there a political analysis that backs up what Paul Starr was saying a moment ago about this being a class-based proposal? I've heard others say that in political terms, the Ryan version of reducing the deficit would inflict pain mostly on Democratic constituencies. But maybe those constituencies happen to be the poor because of what would happen to Medicaid especially and Medicare for people with less money.
Look, I think the gaping, yes is the answer to the question, and I think the gaping proof point for that is the fact that Paul Ryan has decided to leave intact in perpetuity the Bush tax cuts on the wealthiest Americans in the highest income bracket.
And cut them further by 10 more percentage points, right?
Indeed. And so, you know, you've got, I mean, look, and that, you know, is a, you know, if you are, there is a view that would say, and I think this is the view broadly of for instance, the bipartisan commission, the Bowles-Simpson commission, which is to say that, look, if you are serious about reducing the deficit, if that is your primary goal, and not your primary goal being to reshape the role of government in American society, if your primary goal is to reduce the deficit, you need to take on entitlements, as Paul Ryan has done, but you also need to deal with the revenue side of the picture. Mm-hmm. And although he has done some stuff in his budget on tax reform, the fact that he has left the Bush tax cuts intact in perpetuity does suggest that there's a class warfare, but that's a more partisan kind of statement that I'm comfortable with. But it certainly skews the program such that the beneficiaries of this, people who come out better on the other end of this, are people who are richer, and people who come out worse are conceivably, at least, right, where the people who are being asked to shoulder the burden of deficit reduction are those on the lower ends of the income scale.
We're talking about the Ryan deficit reduction plan, and we'll get to the short-term budget showdown, which might result in a government shutdown on Friday night. My guest, John Heilman, who was just speaking, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, Paul Starr, health policy expert at Princeton, co-founder of the American Prospect magazine. He was a health policy advisor under President Clinton. And Ed Hazelmeyer, senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. So, Paul Starr, Republicans will point out that the Democrats don't have a long-term budget vision. This is 10 years, the Ryan plan, that tackles the budget deficit seriously like this. So at the moment, do we have a far-right plan versus no plan when it comes to entitlement reform? And would there be a more acceptable way to you to cut out as much money from the long-term debt?
Well, first of all, I don't accept the premise that John Heilman accepts, that this is a courageous plan to eliminate the deficit. We need to have some independent scoring of some of the numbers that Paul Ryan featured, and I'm not at all confident. When he said this is not a budget, it's a cause. Uh-huh. I think he spoke from the heart. It's a cause. It's not really a budget, and so let's hold off on that judgment. I think they're in for a political surprise. These programs have a lot more support than they have expected. I'm looking at some numbers right now from a survey that was just released a couple of days ago from the Kaiser Foundation. A survey that asked people, "Are you in favor of no reduction, minor reductions, or major reductions in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid?" So that's on Medicare. The proportion in favor of major reductions is just 8%. 56% said no reductions, 35% just minor reductions.
Right.
On Medicaid, the surprise is just 13%.
But Dr. Starr, you as a health policy expert, do you accept that as the bottom line of what the government should do? The trajectory of Medicare spending is toward more and more debt, and so the government has to do something, right?
Well, we do have, we have set in motion a variety of changes in the Affordable Care Act. Some of those are changes that involve new systems of payment, bundled payment, value-based purchasing. We need to get the results of those and then to act on them. In fact, just to come back to this point, the private plans in Medicare have cost the government more than it would have cost had those patients enrolled in traditional Medicare. So the idea of switching to the private insurers as a way to save money is just not real. It's a way to shift the cost to the beneficiaries. The alternative is for more comprehensive means of cost containment that answer not just the government's problem, mm-hmm, but answer the beneficiaries' problem.
And
are
you saying that the reforms that are needed to Medicare to make it sustainable are all contained in the Obama Health Reform Act?
I think actually there's a lot more there than people realize. And you know, it does extend the life of the Medicare Trust Fund by 12 years. So there is significant progress there.
Ed Hazelmeyer from Heritage. The fiscal conservatives always say tax cuts will produce more revenue in the long run because the economy will grow. But from what I've read, the Ryan plan does not make that claim, even over 10 years. Is that right after he cuts the top income tax rate from 35% to 25%? When I asked this question of Congresswoman Blackburn before, she says Heritage crunches the numbers in a way that shows that it might produce more revenue. Did she have that right?
Yeah, she essentially did. I mean, Professor Starr's point, actually, this proposal that the Representative Ryan has put out has been independently done by, analyzed by the CBO. That's the Congressional Budget Office. That's where the numbers are in the proposal. The Congressional Budget Office does what is called fairly static scoring. It doesn't incorporate into its scoring of revenue and spending, you know, behavioral changes that would result. So things like new productivity as a result of tax cuts and tax receipts going up don't wind up in there. Things like the number of people enrolling in a program when you put a new subsidy in, well, they don't factor in that it might induce people to shift from coverage they already have. They don't have as big a score as somebody who does a more dynamic score. Our Center for Data Analysis used recognized tax models to do a dynamic score for a comparison. So, yes, that's true. But on the
larger
point...
And what do you come out with?
Well, they do come out with job growth and revenue gains as well. But the larger point,
I want to know, because this comes up and comes up and comes up. Are you making the claim that if you reduce the top tax rate from 35% to 25%, the government will be taking in more money each year 10 years from now than if you left it the way it is?
I would have to look at that. I just haven't, you know, I'm not an expert on that. I didn't do that analysis, so I'm not familiar with it. But the larger point that I wanted to get to, and this is in what Congressman Ryan put forward, is when you look at, this is well understood by budget folks, including Mrs. Rivlin, across the spectrum, is when you look at the history of taxation and spending in the federal government going back generations, what you find in the tax code is that about every generation or so, we go through a process where we simplify the code. We get rid of a lot of loopholes and deductions, and we lower the rates. And then over time, the rates climb back up, and then in response to that, the loopholes come in. Now, what the net effect is regardless of whether you have the flat rates with fewer, the lower rates with fewer loopholes, or the higher rates with more loopholes, and we've gone through this cycle three or four times over the last 70 years, regardless, the government takes in about the same amount, which is about 20%. 19 to 20% of gross domestic product. So what Representative Ryan clearly says in this bill is that his tax reforms would bring that down to that historic level by lowering rates but closing loopholes and deductions. Now, he actually wants to go further in this, okay? And if you want to make the argument that it's sort of, you know, philosophical, and budget documents are philosophical and ideological, then he actually goes further to envision the tax burden coming down to about 15% of GDP. So that last 5 percentage points between 20 and 15 is I think that's fair to say that that's, you know, a Republican preference for smaller government.
And you don't agree that it would increase inequality in America?
I'm sorry?
Do you not agree that that would increase inequality in America?
No, I don't think it necessarily does, but that's where you get into the details of how those tax reforms are enacted. Remember, what we have done actually in recent years is taken large numbers of lower income Americans off the income tax rolls entirely. So that's still fairly progressive, even when you have lower rates on middle income and upper income people.
You two are going to disagree about this. We're almost out of time. John Heilman, why did Ryan insert this epic 10-year overhaul into the teeth of this Friday night deadline for a government shutdown over the immediate budget? Why not next week after this is perhaps all settled?
Well,
Let me say one thing very quick, Brian, before I answer that question, and I will answer it. But just to go back to what Professor Starr said, I want to be really clear about one thing. You know, he actually sort of he disagreed with my point that there was an act of courage here, and I was really speaking of political courage. He disagreed with that point, and then made my point for me, which is to say there are huge elements of this program that Representative Ryan has put forward that are on their face very unpopular at the moment, and so he has done something. To me, the definition of political courage is to put forward a very detailed plan that you know there's going to be widespread opposition to. I'm not praising the plan. I'm just saying that takes a certain amount of guts.
Okay.
Now, on the second question, I think that the timing was very purposeful, and it was designed, I believe, to make it, in some ways, they thought that it would make it easier, in fact, to get this short-term deal done in the context of the larger deal, which is to say, you know, this short-term deal has really no effect on the long-term deficit whatsoever. And I think that what they wanted to sort of say to the further right elements of the party that right now are the ones that are applying the pressure that are making a short-term deal for the 2011 budget hard to do. By holding this up, it was to say, look, guys, if we're going to fight a huge fight, let's fight it over something that really matters. Let's fight it over, this is where the big stakes are here. Let's get this, you know, you guys, let's not waste all of our cannon fire here and risk shutting down the government, which could be very politically disadvantageous to Republicans.
But it's not working?
Over something that is, in fact, trivial.
But
let's look at the longer view. That's more important.
But it's not working?
Well, I think in some ways it has stiffened the spines of some of the freshmen in the House and some of the Tea Party elements in the party who are saying, you know, this is all turning into one gigantic fight, and if we don't demonstrate will on this easy thing, what they see as an easier thing, this short-term thing, the smaller dollars at stake, if we can't make that happen now, how are we ever going to win the larger fight? So in some ways I think it's actually backfired in the political context and given those people more, they made them more hardline on this shorter term thing rather than cause them to kind of back down and be more amenable to compromise.
Well, we'll see what happens. Of course, on the show, we'll keep talking about the policy and the politics. John Heilman, Ed Hazelmeyer, Paul Starr, thank you all very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will talk about New York Archbishop Timothy Dolan and why he's becoming more controversial. Stay with us.